Are you an architect or interior designer looking for continuing education credits? Look no further than the new Architecture and Design Master Continuing Education Portal. Our new continuing education platform is designed to empower the architect and design community in advancing professional skills by offering the opportunity to earn free continuing education units, CEUs, through online articles and webinars, making it easier than ever to earn the credits you need to maintain your license to practice. There are dozens of courses available approved by the AIA and IDCEC for health, safety, and welfare credit. Search by keyword, topic, or accrediting body to find a course and learn at your own pace. Head over to arcdesignmaster.com and register today. Hello and welcome to the I Hear Design podcast, your source for interior design and architecture news, interviews, and opinions. I'm your host, Robert Yemenin, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in to this episode and for supporting the podcast. If you're enjoying these conversations, would you do us a favor and tell your colleagues about the podcast? We want to continue growing our community of listeners and feature guests who are passionate about design and the impact it can have on the world around us. Speaking of community, I recently sat down with Jack Chafin, an architect and partner at Seattle-based Johnston Architects, about the intersection of community and technology. These seemingly disparate concepts aren't nearly as divergent as perhaps I thought, as I learned during this lively conversation. As it turns out, technology can be a powerful tool in helping to create more equitable communities and impactful community-led projects, as Jack shared during our discussion. Have a listen. All right. Well, hi, Jack. Welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Robert. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Where are you dialing in from today?
Seattle, Washington. Not so sunny Seattle, Washington.
Well, I'm supposed to be in sunny South Florida, but it is a cloudy, rainy day here, too. So, but it's a good way to kick off the afternoon. We've got a lot to talk about today. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like this past year, advancements in technology, we've been hearing a lot about AI. I mean, it's just dominated so many different conversations, you know, whether it's in the design industry and architecture or even in my world of publishing. So much is changing so quickly. And to me, one of the things that seems to stand out in conversations that I've had is this overarching theme of like, how can we better leverage technology to improve human experiences, you know, rather than shy away from it, even though I know there's ample reason to have some caution when it comes to overusing technology and all that. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself already. So let me wind things back a little bit and have you introduce yourself to our listeners who may not be familiar with you or Johnston Architects. So Jack, tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe how you found your way into the field of architecture design. Mm-hmm. Anybody inspired or mentored you along the way, things you've learned, that sort of thing. If you want to just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, I went to school and I got a bachelor's of arts in religious studies and English.
Okay.
And when I was getting ready to graduate, even though I really enjoyed my time at Kenyon University, I didn't have that many job opportunities that were presented to me that I really wanted to pursue. You know, a lot of my peers were going into publishing or law, and just for whatever reason, that wasn't as appealing to me. So I started putting feelers out there, and actually one of my early mentors helped me sort of discover my love of art and architecture. And I had always taken art classes throughout, you know, I probably could have been a triple major, but that's crazy. So So his name was Royal Rhodes, and he was a Catholic priest who taught religious studies, and he helped me to sort of uncover my desire to pursue architecture. And so I applied to a bunch of colleges that would accept an English and religion major into their masters of architecture, and ended up at Morgan State University in Baltimore. And, you know, from the first day, it was just the greatest thing. You know, it was just like I couldn't eat enough. It was the place that I really needed and wanted to be. And so, yeah, graduate school went by really quickly. And I spent about 15 more years in Baltimore working for a firm that is no longer called RCG, Richter Kornbrook Scribble, where my mentor there was Jonathan Fishman. And Jonathan was an excellent architect who I think he showed me the way to run a business and not get too stressed out about it. You know, that it's going to be okay. And, you know, we can make it in the architecture world and not have to pull our hair out along the way.
Great skill to have, right?
Yes. So true. If you can be calm, you know, in the midst of the storm, it's a lot nicer than freaking out. And so he was sort of this calming presence who helped me to sort of grow and mature as an architect. And then we had the opportunity to move to Seattle. And in 2008, I started working for LMN Architects, which is where my two passions, one for digital fabrication and building information modeling and architecture, came together. And it was a place where I was allowed to explore those in, you know, really great detail, to the point where a few of my colleagues and I started a fabrication arm called Frankenstein Incorporated that was pretty much a subsidiary of LMN. We did most of our work was for LMN, but it consisted of a CNC router in a friend's garage. And it was really sort of our first foray into the ability to take ideas that we had in our head and, you know, make them real or real enough that we could translate what we were thinking to contractors and fabricators of our building. And I found that to be extraordinarily invaluable experience. And during that time, one of my mentors was Ray Johnston. And Ray, when I was starting up this little company, I'd never started a company from scratch. So Ray helped me to understand, you know, sort of the processes and procedures I needed to go through, what kind of corporation we needed to be, where did I get my insurance, all of those things. And so he was a great sounding board, and we would have lunch or dinner monthly and discuss what I was doing he found interesting. And then he was obviously instrumental in getting our little business up and off the ground. So 4 years later, I was at Johnston Architects and trying to take a little bit of the things that I'd learned along the way with me to this firm. And so we have developed a pretty interesting digital practice, design technology mm-hmm. practice here. And that's where I am today. I'm a partner yeah. at Johnston Architects.
That's so cool. Yeah. And I love the early part of your story, just about having this passion for architecture, yet having an English degree. I mean, that's kind mm-hmm. of, that's where I come from. You know, I have an English mm-hmm. background, but when I was younger, I just always thought I was going to be an architect. And turns out I'm writing about architecture and design. So, you know, it's funny, but that you made the leap, you know, and I grew up in a faith-based community. So, you know, interesting overlaps there. But Jack, you mentioned your passion for technology and design, and I understand that you've sort of leveraged those skills to create, you know, more adaptable and equitable communities. So where do you see these seemingly, I guess you would say, disparate drivers sort of intersect, or how do you see that they're interrelated?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And one that we kind of think about all the time. We do a lot of library projects in the office and are in so many different types of communities, from very small rural communities to more urban and larger communities. And so mm-hmm. the scales of the projects kind of correlate. But we're always kind of asking ourselves, how do we make, because libraries sometimes can be the one civic building in a community, you know, and how do you make this building reflect the place in which you're building it, designing mm-hmm. it? And obviously that's through the input of the people who live there and through the translation of their hopes and dreams into something that's real. And so there are a number of ways that we utilize technology to sort of help us along that path and to engender sort of this collaborative back and forth with the communities in which we work. So one that I was thinking about specifically, and I will have to give a shout out here to Shane Lehman in our mm-hmm. office, because it's a tool that he developed. It's a web-based tool where a lot of times we find when we do community engagement, people can't always be in person, you know, and especially during COVID, obviously mm-hmm. people weren't in person. So it self-selects for a certain audience. So we're constantly trying to figure out how can we get the other folks who can't be at those community engagement events to participate. And so this was a web-based product that he developed where it could be anything from a park to a huge development to a library floor plan. And essentially what you're given the ability to take Lego pieces, you know, virtual Lego pieces and say, okay, what's really important to me is that we have a nice children's area, and I want it to be in the sunny spot of the site. And so people just start building their library or their park. And through that means of communication, we can get thousands of inputs. And what's remarkable for us on our side, ingesting that information, is that we can then see in like a heat map or a topological map where people are putting the different program pieces and why. And it starts to become really obvious sort of what the people want. And generally, we don't have to pull out the architect hat and say, no, we can't go there. You know, generally, we're able to work around what the desire of the community is as it's expressed sort of in that very digital and, you know, techie way. And I find that in some ways, it's more engaging than those in-person events. I love the in-person events. I love, you know, getting rolling up our sleeves and, you know, getting out the markers and the stickers and getting creative in person. But I also feel that, you know, that's such a small segment of the population that when you start to see these heat maps develop and you know that there have been hundreds to thousands of input, you really can start to see sort of an overwhelming sentiment within a community as to what it is that they desire for that piece of architecture. So that one, I think, is a real obvious tool, a way to leverage technology to, you know, help make not only the communication equitable, but to make the building equitable. So you can also do it around not only spaces, but around both priorities. So like, you know, not word clouds, but things similar to word clouds, like what words, what images are inspiring you about this new building. And we can do the same sort of collation of data from those types of inputs as well. So I find that to be really useful, and especially during COVID, of course, but even coming out of COVID, you know, it's nice to have both ways of communicating with the community.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Are there a couple of projects that you'd like to highlight that infuse some of these concepts into, you know, the design of the finished project?
Well, what's interesting is, so we have the Winthrop Library in Winthrop, Washington, which is a, you know, not small, but not big, relatively rural community. And they had done just a tremendous job of sort of bootstrapping library funding together. And the library itself is not an extraordinarily expensive piece of architecture, but the way that it was able to tie into the community, I think, is kind of unique amongst our projects. And it does so in a number of ways. So the first thing that I found that was interesting was, how do you site the building? And a lot of times that's extremely important, because how the building relates to the community can have a lot to do with how it just physically sits within the community. And what's important to the siting of the building, you know, is there a view to a mountain? And in this case, there was. Is there proximity to, you know, well-used paths? So this was sitting on a very near to a well-used walking, hiking path, and was also at the crux of an important intersection. So, you know, how we sited the building, you know, based on those inputs and obviously the inputs of the community, was extremely important to the success of the project. And what it did was it kind of made us leverage some of our other digital tools in order to make the actual space of the library great. And what I mean by that is, because we were sort of focusing it on this view and projecting, you know, the building footprint down in a way that took that into account, as well as these other parameters that I was speaking of, the control of the sunlight, the natural daylight, was extremely important and was a little bit more difficult maybe than usual, because you were not just putting it directly in the path of, you know, south facing sun, easy to control. So what we ended up doing was we do a whole bunch of initial iterative daylighting analysis studies in office. We were able to do that, you know, shifting the building, changing the roof form, applying screens, applying sunshades, to figure out sort of what the most optimal way of developing the interior space was as far as its relation to natural light, which is extremely important in a library. You don't want to always be reading by artificial light. You want to have that experience of being able to read with natural daylight. Mm-hmm. And so what we ended up finding was that because of the way because of where we wanted the main reading room and where the view was and where the way the building was oriented, we were getting a ton of glare into the most important, you know, reading portion of the building. And so we looked at a number of different strategies how to mitigate that. And essentially the best strategy was to put a very large horizontal sunshade above the window. And that led us to one of the bigger design moves of the project, which was instead of just putting in a sunshade, we ended up extending the roof out over that portion of the building. And if you look at the project online, it has this very large sort of barn-like gable roof. And so we just kept extending it out to cover the glare that was coming in through the natural, from the sunlight. And it also, it's like this happy accident. It ended up creating a covered walk from the parking area to the main entry. And so it was just kind of like this fortuitous event that was brought to us, you know, via the wonders of technology and daylighting analysis.
That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to love it when that happens, right? And the happy accidents.
Absolutely. You know it's right then.
For sure. Well, I mean, it sounds like you at least partially answered my next question, but you know, how you're leveraging technological tools in new ways to enhance experiences for occupants of a space. And that was, I guess, like a happy accident where that happened, where you're not only eliminating glare, but now you also have a covered walkway. But how do you make the process of integrating technology into your projects like more seamless?
That's a very interesting question. And I think that, you know, the more I've been involved in digital fabrication or taking, you know, bits and bytes and putting it in making something real, the more I realize that it can be relatively seamless, but there's always manual labor, you know, it's never truly seamless. And just because a robot can kick out, you know, a panel with a perforation pattern doesn't mean that the job is done and that there's always interesting manual portions of projects that you just don't necessarily anticipate. Even now, and I've been doing this for like, gosh, at least 14, 16 years, regularly, you know, it's sometimes difficult to make it truly seamless. And I think that mainly is because we're never doing the same thing over and over again. I think like daylighting analysis, as we were just talking about, we do that on pretty much every project in the office. So it's become relatively a seamless work, part of our workflow. But, you know, speaking about making buildings that are very specific to their communities, we always try to instill something unique through leveraging digital fabrication into our buildings. And that could be, and let's just stick with the Winthrop Library. In the Winthrop Library in the children's area, there's a family restroom. It sits in the middle of the floor plan. And it was kind of this, what are we going to do with this thing that's sitting in the middle of our beautiful, open, daylit floor plan? It's obviously functionally necessary. And so we ended up creating kind of we made it into an object within the space that was also acted as a reading nook, cubbies for the children to climb in and read a book, etc. But what was interesting about that was that we were able to, one of my colleagues here, Mona Zellers, created this micro pattern that was hand drawn by her of flora and fauna of the region. And so it was this beautiful pattern of all these different shapes. And we needed to somehow translate that like onto this object. We ended up CNCing some very nice plywood in that pattern to create almost like a little tree canopy that wraps around the entire object. And I'm probably not doing it justice with my words, but definitely check it out online. But it ended up being an extreme, I mean, I think the panels themselves were $5,000. So it ended up being an extremely cost-effective way of introducing something that was absolutely specific to the region and that people, you know, when they walk up will know, you know, what that, if that's a wasp or if that's a local flower, et cetera, will immediately be able to understand that this is something that was made for us, for this region, and is representative of our community. And that's just like, you know, a small sort of example, but a way that, you know, if we were pulling something off the shelf, it wouldn't have quite the same impact.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I understand Johnston Architects has what it's called an innovation lab. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the role that it plays in your firm's work?
Yeah, it's actually this constantly growing fabrication room. It started out as a room in the office, and it is slowly sort of taking over portions of the office. And we're lucky enough to have some space in our office. And I think that, you know, having hybrid work, et cetera, you know, there is some more space in our offices these days to sort of be able to spread out and do these things. But it is essentially where we keep all of our tools for making things. And we don't have, you know, we don't have the ability to cut metal. You know, there's some things that we just don't, that we definitely still partner with fabricators on to realize. But for instance, you know, we still do large scale fabrication in the office. We just ended up about 2 months ago shipping out a 12 foot wide by 8 foot tall interactive digital peg wall, kind of like a light bright for the Edmonds Library Children's Area. And it was installed about 2 months ago, but it occupied a good portion of the center of our office for months as we iterated kind of through the all of the different electronic issues and different designs that we had on the back end that nobody will ever see, but it makes the thing go and makes it interesting. And it was great because it was central to the office, literally in the middle of the office. And so anybody who came into the office, whether it's an interior designer, a marketing director, could interact with it, provide feedback. You know, it wouldn't it be cool if inputs for us that were really instrumental in helping us to create the finished product. And now it's a thing that I think, having spent so much time and effort on that individual object, I think it's something that we're really hopeful that we can explore in future children's areas or wherever. So yeah, the Innovation Lab is, yeah, it's where dreams become reality.
Right. For lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Truly.
Jack, you talked earlier a little bit about community and equity, equitable communities. And I understand that Johnston Architects also has something called the JUST program. Can you tell us more about that initiative and what it entails?
Yeah. So the International Living Futures Institute runs the JUST program, and we are a signatory member. So it's kind of like a reporting device that they've created, which is really cool. And it's something that I'd wanted to do for a number of years. And when I got to Johnston Architects, I immediately got the thumbs up to pursue it. And what's wonderful about it is it's kind of like a nutrition label for your business, but it focuses on social equity, diversity, inclusion, and justice. And I like to think of it as holding up a specific mirror to your business and seeing how you look and seeing where you might be able to improve, maybe, you know, push a little here, pull a little there. And it has been, I would say, since I've been here, the largest contributor to change in our office of anything that we've really done. I mean, there hasn't been any external input that's had as big a lever on the way that we've changed our business over the past, I guess it's now 6 years. And just an example of that is it was created for the AEC community. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of portions in there for contractors relatively specifically, including the idea of having unions and being receptive to unions. Mm-hmm. And you know, we know that unions are taking a small foothold in our architectural community, but they're really not very mature in this community and haven't been really over our modern history. So we worked with the JUST folks to come up with a way that we could have that same kind of employee input, that same kind of employee autonomy within our firm that doesn't have unions present. And so we came up with this idea called the Feedback Forum, and it's been in place now for 6 years. And essentially what it is it's an open forum where no management is present, where all of the employees get together and they sort of go down the list of feedback that they would like to see in, you know, the management respond to as far as how the firm runs. And that has had, you know, some significant impact on the way that we work. Everything from how we stock our medicine cabinet to our 401k to how we make our pay scale equitable and how we define roles and responsibilities, job titles, all of those things have come from that forum or from just in that forum. And so it has had just, I don't know, it's hard to overstate the impact that it's had on our firm. And I would highly recommend it if anybody's listening to at least look into it for your firm. It's not that scary. It's not that many hours. You know, you do it every 2 years that you do your reporting, and it's really not a huge time commitment, but it's an extremely important and useful tool we've found.
Yeah. Sounds like, I mean, I would imagine it would be a great tool for attracting and retaining talent, right, for the firm?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been people who have come here just because they saw we were a member of Just, especially early on when it was less ubiquitous. I mean, I wouldn't say it's ubiquitous now, but there are more, definitely more architecture firms in Just than there used to be. But yeah, and now those folks are like our biggest, you know, advocates as far as DEI is concerned, and are actually starting to lead all those efforts and take some of the workload off my shoulders, which has been awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I know that aligns a lot with the values of the younger generations. And speaking of which, I understand you're also teaching architecture at the University of Washington. And, you know, I was curious just like kind of what topics are you focusing on, you know, with architecture students today? What's the next generation preparing for as they're coming out of school and going into the workplace?
That is a great, great question. And I was introduced to the instructor position through Mary Johnston. When I got here, Mary had been teaching the studio. It's an architecture studio. It's the first in the graduate school. So it's the whole cohort all together in one studio, which I think is really interesting. So you have like 40 to 50 people. And so I substituted for Mary for years and then just sort of slid in and started teaching it myself. But it is always focused on the urban realm first. So we will pick a site in Seattle somewhere, and we will analyze that from a number of different perspectives, historical, community, et cetera, and topographical, all those different types of ways that architects look at communities. But what has been really interesting, and I think that you were alluding to it, is our younger generations or folks who are newer to architecture, as they come into the profession, they are definitely more focused on how our built environment affects the equity in communities. You know, displacement, gentrification have been in the past 4 or 5 years, significant drivers of what the students are producing and what they're studying and what they're producing. And that is, you know, I hate to say it, but it's been kind of self-directed. You know, it's been like the students have been leading the charge. And I think it's been great because it's added this really significant layer of study and influence onto their projects that maybe didn't exist 12, 20 years ago. You know, it probably existed, but at a much smaller level. And so what we're seeing is projects that develop sort of from the community up and less about us applying our architecture on the community. And it's really been, it's made the studio a lot better. It's made the studio a lot more thoughtful about the moves that we're making as architects within communities and how, you know, it could be hurtful or it could be healing. And what are those, you know, what are those different ways that we can provide shelter, housing, et cetera, in a community without displacing that community, where we can maybe amplify the positives of the community, hopefully smooth over some of the negatives of the community or things that don't exist in the community that maybe should. And so I think that's one of the things that I've seen that's been the biggest change since I've been an instructor, and has really been heartening, because I'm sure you're probably aware Seattle has a significant housing shortage, and there's such huge pressure on housing here and housing equity that coming up with solutions isn't not going to happen tomorrow. And we need a we need a generation of folks who are thinking about this in our industry, I think, to be able to really solve it and put it to bed. But you know, so far we're not there yet.
Right. No, definitely. But and I imagine part of that whole conversation and part of the value system is also about sustainability. I mean, as much as it is about equity for the next generation, right?
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about a lot is, you know, sustainability has a lot to do with equity, you know, that, you know, sustainability should not just be for the rich folks who can afford to put solar and heat pumps on their house, that it really is about distributing that those ideas to all communities and making it a healthy building is good for anybody, you know, and everybody. So creating these healthy buildings and these healthy environments is, you know, a significant focus of what we do. And it's funny because it's, you bring it up, it's kind of very ingrained, and it's a very Seattle Pacific Northwest kind of sustainability is just like in the veins. So we don't think about it very much.
Right.
But it is, it's extraordinarily important. And I think that as we, you know, we're sort of undergoing this mass timber revolution right now and talking about, we're starting to get into discussions about how we dismantle buildings instead of demolish buildings. And I just read an article about a group who is, you know, reclaiming old lumber out of buildings rather than sending it to the landfill, and like how they pull the nails out and make it reusable and replane it and all of that. And it's just, I think that sort of that and adaptive reuse are kind of our next phase of this revolution. And it's been, it's just been really interesting to, you know, see it sort of come up through the younger generation or the newer generation, and us as a practice, you know, leveraging those ideas for our clients and then seeing how clients respond to it has been extremely interesting, because I think that the idea of resiliency is great, but a lot of times it takes a good deal of education for our clients to understand, well, what does that mean exactly? You know, what does that mean for us, and why is that important? And so it's been a great way of bringing along this newest wave of architectural sustainability thought to our practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just personally love adaptive reuse projects. I think they're just so great to see, you know, these old buildings being repurposed. And then to, you know, to your point about the housing crisis, you know, you have these stranded assets with commercial real estate and office buildings. And, you know, how do we creatively rebuild these into affordable housing or, you know, equitable housing? And it's just going to be so great to see how architects and designers are so integral, you know, to solving some of these challenges that we're facing right now. So that's great.
Yeah.
I guess as we sort of, you know, wind down the conversation here, Jack, are there any other topics or trends, thoughts you want to share with our listeners that we haven't talked about yet in this conversation?
Well, we haven't talked much about AI. And I do think that it is, you know, it is kind of the elephant in the room. And we definitely are you know, jumping in the deep end a little bit more, you know, or getting our feet wet. But it's, I think it's a very interesting tool, and it's, we've started dabbling with it in a number of different ways, but, and it's hard to put my finger on, you know, sort of what's going to be the most important way that we use, end up interacting with it. But I, from what I'm starting to see and what we're starting to do, it's getting better at sort of the mundane tasks that we don't want to do. So the other day I had it write a spec section for me, and then I read it versus our old spec section, you know, ChatGPT. And I just was like, interesting. It got 90% of the way there. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, is there a way for some of the more menial tasks that we do for AI to help us do it immediately? And I think absolutely. And we need to leverage that as much as we possibly can. We have been dabbling with it in actual architecture and aesthetic studies. I wouldn't say we've had great success so far, but you can definitely sort of see where it's headed. We had a study recently for a theater in Seattle that we have to reclad. And so it's taking a whole building that everybody knows, and we've got to reclad it, and there's color involved. And so it's a, you know, it's a political thing. It's an aesthetic thing. It's an opinion thing.
Yes.
And it was really fun to just run through 1,000 color studies in AI just to see what it spit out. Mm-hmm. And there were some interesting ideas that came out of it, you know, just by looking at so many different ideas, sometimes you can suss out something that's actually worthwhile. And that took almost no time.
Yes.
That being said, still think that there's room for the architect to be an editor, to be a creator.
It's for sure.
Just not, the three-dimensional aspect of AI is not so great yet. We are starting to see it help with iterative sort of parametric studies, which is great. You know, it can kind of do some things on its own, which is nice. It relieves us and lets us go do the more fun stuff that we want to study. But yeah, it's, I would love to have the same conversation in a year and then 5 years. Because right now, obviously, it's sort of nascent still, but it's starting to creep into our workflows, which I think is interesting. And even people who are not, you know, tech nerds are starting to see it creep into their workflows as well.
For sure. Yeah. Same thing here with the, you know, with publishing and editing. And I think those that are going to be successful, regardless of what industry it is the ones that learn how to harness it to become more efficient, right? And to, to use it for what it is. And it's a great tool. So. All right. Well, Jack, where can our listeners go to learn more about Johnston Architects and the work you do as a firm?
Well, you can follow us on Instagram at Johnston Architects. JohnstonArchitects.com is our website. And so those are our two primary places where you can reach out to us and see what we do. But yeah, that would be great.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. And more importantly, for being a guest on the podcast, Jack, it's been great chatting with you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you, Robert.
Sure. Well, for our listeners out there, be sure to head over to Johnston Architects' website to learn more about their studio, as well as to view the Winthrop Library project that Jack discussed during our conversation. And also be sure to subscribe to the I Hear Design podcast if you haven't done so already. We appreciate you making us a part of your day and joining us for today's conversation. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, be well, everyone.